My name is Ariel. I moved to the US at 19. I spoke no English and I struggled finding job opportunities. Everything I have, I owe to the Adult Literacy Center and getting my high school diploma at age 22.
It was an honor helping you achieve your greatness. Now you're helping others achieve theirs. It inspires me.
When you graduate, they graduate. Find free and supportive adult education centers near you at finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
It's the Breakfast Club, the world's most dangerous morning show.
Hey!
Angela Yee is kind of like the big sister that always pokes you in the forehead.
That's not how it goes?
That's not how anything goes.
Yemi's really like a robot. One of the best DJs ever.
Believe that.
Charlamagne is the wild card.
And I'm about to give somebody the credit they deserve for being stupid.
I know, that's right.
What is wrong with you?
Listen to The Breakfast Club weekday mornings from 6 to 10 on 106.7 The Beat. Columbus's real hip-hop and R&B.
Welcome to Strictly Business, Variety's weekly podcast featuring conversations with industry leaders about the business of media and entertainment. I'm Cynthia Littleton, co-editor-in-chief of Variety. Today, my guest is Scott Kundell, founder and CEO of Sox Entertainment. Kundell made a career in Hollywood out of being one of those executives who is indispensable to any big media company. He became an expert in making it rain or selling top-tier content to the highest bidders around the world. This job description can be opaque, head of sales, leader of distribution, but the mission is simple, monetization. Kundell was a key rainmaker at CBS and at Paramount Pictures before that. Amid the post-Leslie Moonves shakeup at CBS in 2018, Kundell headed for the exit with a vision of finally letting his inner entrepreneur run free. His company helped bring Judge Judith Scheinlin to a new bench presiding over the daily Judy Justice court show for Amazon's Freevee. He's done a lot of behind-the-scenes work advising friends and clients on how to value media assets in this changing environment. That work also gives him great insight into where the hockey puck is headed. That's all coming up after the break.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. Oracle.com/strategic.
Snakes, zombies, sharks, heights, speaking in public. The list of fears is endless. But while you're clutching your blanket in the dark, wondering if that sound in the hall was actually a footstep, the real danger is in your hand when you're behind the wheel. And while you might think a great white shark is scary, what's really terrifying and even deadly is distracted driving. Eyes forward. Don't drive distracted. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Hey, it's Zuko and Kayla from The Wake Up Call. Enjoy your podcast, but when you're done, don't forget about us. We have a radio show. We try to bring a smile to your face every morning.
We also talk to some of the hottest country stars of today, and we like to share some good news with That's What I Like.
Because Lord knows that's hard to find. When you're done podcasting your podcast, listen to us at 92.3 WCOL.
Set your preset on your radio right now, and don't forget you can listen to us online on the iHeartRadio app.
And we're back with a frank discussion of where the money is in TV with Sox Entertainment founder Scott Kundell.
You've been out there in the trenches. as an entrepreneur with Sox Entertainment for the past couple of years after a very long career at CBS and Paramount. I guess I want to start by asking you, as you are out there putting together shows and deals and packages and consulting as you do on a lot of high-level media strategy, where do you see the most opportunity in the business for content creators, content owners? Where are you getting traction right now as you are out selling different packages and things?
Well, it's more, it's about producing efficiently. It's about giving volume. You know, a lot of the companies right now have an advertising model as well as a subscription model. And it's probably a necessity because I think people want to get as much content as possible and they can only afford a certain amount. So they'll make some sacrifices to watch things with ads in it to get a lower price. And for the bigger companies, I think they need to monetize their content with advertising. And also, you know, it's been talked about and you've written about it. Everyone's kind of written about it. It's the prices have really escalated and there is somewhat of an arms race in terms of content spending. So, you know, sure, I'd like to sell a show for, you know, $14, $15 million an hour. But I like the idea of producing shows that potentially people could binge on it. It's advertiser friendly. People want to put it without ads on in the subscription model that also has a back end, a viable back end that I could distribute. And so for my company's business model, and I could talk about how I approach the business, I'm looking for as many paths to generate revenue for my company. So it's not just like selling a show and getting an EP fee and getting paid as an executive producer. It's about representing other pieces of the puzzle, whether it's the IP or a talent or a writer or showrunner producer, and having some sort of arrangement with them where I could get a piece of what I'm, you know, representing them in this project, producing it, and then having back-end distribution rights or format rights, and then profit participation. Mm-hmm. So for me, a lot of what I do is, you know, people say, oh, you're a producer now, and I kind of laugh humbly because there are real producers out there who are, you know, in the control room and on the floor and getting into the, you know, nuts and bolts of making TV.
Picking the shades of the curtains
in
the set.
Yeah, and sometimes I joke around saying, yeah, the biggest decision I make is what to order for lunch. So when people ask me, you're a producer, what do you produce? My answer usually is, I produce money.
which is no matter what, even the last couple of years, there's been a few departures from that. No matter what, money is what makes the biz in showbiz go round.
The big thing that evolved and changed the business was the volume of business and putting people to work. I think agents did a very good job of capitalizing on it, but you know, will those big paydays of what Dick Wolf gets or David E. Kelly, yes, it did seem like it was going in a different direction based on the leverage and all the spending that was being done. Not to mention the fact that there was more data through the streamers. And if you look at a lot of the, you know, shows on some of the streamers, they typically weren't going more than three seasons.
Right.
And because they wanted to spend their money to provide new shows that gave people a reason to subscribe that they could market. Mm-hmm. They've outsmarted the industry. This is what I will say. I would say the streaming companies, you know, put aside the ones that are in other businesses that, you know, this is like a side business, and I'm obviously talking about Apple and Amazon. They outsmarted the business because they had real numbers. They knew how to use that data to their advantage. And traditional media companies aren't judged the same way to Wall Street the way the streaming companies were. You know, and so they're playing by a different set of rules. And it made it very, very hard for them to compete. And the streaming companies were also very smart of identifying who are the talented people in old media and getting them.
Yeah.
So do I think it'll switch? Well, certainly it'll switch with big talent. The leverage will revert, and they'll demand back end and certain rights. And then they might, a big talent might opt to go with a second tier streaming service because they are getting that back end. That talent that goes there creates a monster hit, and the people at the bigger tier one companies are saying, we blew this, look what this could have done for us. Now we put these other guys on the map. Mm-hmm. So I think that is a scenario that could very well happen.
Mm-hmm. Does it seem to you like the sort of the return of advertising into the conversation about streaming is opening? It would seem like it would have to be open doors for more entrepreneurial efforts and more different forms of content licensing versus the cost plus that has been the norm, if you can call it the norm, over the last certainly 5-6 years.
Yeah, I mean, what's happening is that I think when streaming first started, it was very niche, and then now it's becoming more, as they have so many subscribers, it's broad, like broadcasting. And they've also have done things and gotten viewers. I remember when Disney was out selling Grey's Anatomy, they couldn't, they sold it basically to themselves at Lifetime, and no one watched it, and it was a lot of money. And yet my daughter, who's, a teenager, is watching Grey's Anatomy on Netflix. Was watching it before she went away to college. And I'm saying they've been able to do things in a way and get viewers to watch things that traditional linear television was not able to do. And I think it's about marketing and understanding the audience. And it's where they've won. Because in that first deal they did, they probably got a sweetheart deal on what they paid for it. So it's that type of insight that is they're just smarter.
You had a long career at Paramount and then CBS. What made you decide that the time was right to launch Sox Entertainment?
Well, truth be told, I looked at where the business was going, and I was in the most uncertainty. I wasn't uncertain where the business was going, that streaming was going to be as big as it was. I got CBS did the streaming business with that first Netflix deal, then we did an Amazon deal, we did a Hulu. I knew that we had to be in that business. It was really knowing where my company was going and whether or not I wanted to participate in it. So we, in 18, were post-emerge with Viacom, as you know. Then we ended up suing a controlling shareholder.
Much drama ensued.
There was a lot of drama, and I was probably one of the only people, one of the very few people who worked on both sides. I was a head of distribution and president of Paramount Distribution. Then I went on the CBS side. I did this, ran a division and then eventually elevated to corporate. But I knew the players on both sides. And from where I was, unless I knew for sure that I was going to be controlling the whole empire on both sides, meaning all the content and licensing and distribution. I didn't want to get involved in that dogfight because we know what happens in mergers. And B, I was being asked by, at a very high level, at one of the major companies, not a traditional media company, about how I'd go about licensing their stuff. And when I heard that and heard there was an opportunity, and they went to try and hire me, I said, there's no way I would ever go back for that type of job just doing that, but maybe I'd launch my own company and you would be my first client and I would exclusively sell your product exclusively for like a year and a half. And that's when my head started going spinning, saying I really probably should start my own company. And that the conversations began with one very large company, and then I had different ideas. The RSNs had to be spun off from Disney during the merger with Fox, and I was in play to potentially buy them. As I'm a huge sports fan, I saw sports gambling. That was one thing that I thought was going to happen, and obviously it's arrived and it's there. And one of the biggest advertising clients right now for these companies are mm-hmm. DraftKings and all these sports betting companies. So I pivoted in my head again, and this is about like how am I going to make the most amount of money. And so I, you know, was very involved in that. I was working with a bank, and everything just happened very, very quickly. I wasn't sure what avenue I was going to go into. Could I actually buy a network if I can't buy the RSNs? But I was thinking very, very big. And then the pandemic hit. And it was the last year at CBS was like kind of like, you know, a rough year. We were paralyzed. We were paralyzed by the lawsuit, paralyzed by a potential merger. We were growing CBS All Access. There was confusion on what should go on the service and what we should license. And I like to work, and I like to make money. And when you put me in a position where I'm being paralyzed is not the state that I want to be in. I was watching the movie the other night. There was a line in the movie Munich, you know, what do you fear? And I think Eric Bana said something like stillness was the line there in that movie. And that's kind of how I am. I wanted to keep moving. And so I went out and I looked at like, what are the big pieces that could help move my company? And I just started to talk about, I was involved with a comic book company, Aftershock, on representing their rights to in their IP. Judy picked up the phone and called me and said, I want to distribute a show, because she didn't want to be at CBS anymore because their negotiations, I guess, fell apart, which I was reticent to do because I worked at CBS and, you know, I didn't want to be perceived as taking their, you know, talent from them.
Don't leave us. We'll be back with more tales from the trenches from Sox Entertainment founder Scott Kundell.
Check the back seat. Check the back seat.
All right, come here.
Check the back seat.
Gets in your head, right? Good. Because every year, dozens of children are forgotten in the backseat of a car by a parent or caregiver. All never thought it could happen to them. But with changes in routines, distractions, or a sleeping child, it can happen to anyone. Parked cars get hot, fast, and can be deadly. So get it in your head.
Check the backseat.
A message from NHTSA and the Ad Council.
And we're back with more from Sox Entertainment founder Scott Kundell.
Given that the regional sports networks that were spun off from as part of the Fox-Disney deal, given that those appear to have one foot in bankruptcy, do you feel like you dodged a bullet there?
I was trying to have as a partner a different type of company. And knowing what this company is now doing with a very big sports franchise, that was the right, I think I had it right.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the model what Sinclair is doing right now is very, very difficult. Not just the advertising part of it, but the rates they're getting, they have no leverage, and the MVPDs, the bundle's going away.
Right. It's basically an old school, we're going to use our stations and the sports to clobber cable operators over the head.
I had a different model. Mm-hmm. I had a different partner. That partner ended up being a little bit in that business and is a partner on one RSN. And my model was different than the traditional model. I believed that it would have worked and would have thrived. And in that sense, I wouldn't have been dodging the bullet. Going out and raising, you know, billions of dollars and owning them like Sinclair does, yes, that would have been a mistake. And I saw that when the opportunity dissipated with the one other buyer to be a partner in it, I then pivoted to, you know, two or three different opportunities.
Can you talk about what you learned in dealing with Netflix at that time, 2014, 2015? What was it like dealing with Netflix and setting that deal? What did you learn about the streaming economy at that time?
Well,
money was gushing out of the faucets at the company, right?
People thought, you know, early on when I finally convinced management at CBS that we should be licensing streaming companies at the same time when Jeff Bukas was calling Netflix the Albanian army.
As if the Albanian army was going to come up and take over Europe, right?
When I saw that opportunity and I saw that what they were willing to spend and to build a service, I was spending a lot of time there. And they also have really great free food on Maple Drive. So I was going there every day and having lunch.
That's old school Netflix before Hollywood, yeah.
And so I spent a lot of time there, and I knew that they wanted to get as much content and make the service valuable to a subscriber. And so from my standpoint is, what could I put on there and have, you know, non-exclusive rights, because CBS was very protective about their rights. Mm-hmm. And initially we did a very... you know, lucrative output deal as well as a catalog deal. That was first. Then there was the CW content, which, believe it or not, for as young as we thought it was for broadcast, I saw an opportunity for it to be even younger on a streaming service. Mm-hmm. And, I got called into my CEO's office, and he's like, he sat me down and he said, the only division of this company that loses money is our 50% equity stake in the CW. What would you do? And I said, let me think about it. I'll get back to you. And I left his office. And an hour later, I came back to his office and I said, I think we should just stream the entire network in addition to linear. And I think we could probably get a lot of money for it. And I started to, it was a really tough thing to do because of the other partner, and it was Warner Brothers, which is owned by Time Warner, which is the same company that owned HBO. And HBO was in this PR battle about, who's the king of subscription television. And at the time it was HBO. And then number two was Showtime. There was a really tough, to convince the head of Warner Brothers at the time that we should be doing this. But we were a partner and the network was losing money. And after working really hard with some really incredibly smart people, and that was really when I, Ted Sarandos and Cindy Hahn, at that point, when Ted was, the content officer, 9 years ago, he was in the trenches of all of these deals, and Cindy Holland is brilliant. And, I learned a lot about the way that they valued product, and I got a little bit of insight to it, and we worked hard, and we took it to marketplace, and we ended up, doing a deal that was worth, ended up being billions, and it saved the network, which is good for broadcast, it was good for the parent companies, and ultimately it was really good for Netflix. And I knew that it worked and it was good because that we divvied it up into two windows. We had a Hulu window, which was like within 1 week, and then the catalog all went in an output deal to Netflix.
Right, because Time Warner had a stake in Hulu at that time.
That's they it. Did. Yeah. So for them, it was really lucrative. Actually, I don't know if they bought in. At the time we did the first deal, I don't think Time Warner had a stake in it. It was only later mm-hmm. on they bought into it. But the real proof of the pudding is when the deal came available, Netflix bought the entire, both windows. And it became a really hairy negotiation because Hulu, they thought they were so smart and thought they, could buy the first window for less money than they paid for it. There were no other players for it. They were wrong. And, Netflix eventually bought it out, and I think they did pretty well with it. And obviously, the partners did well with it. Mm-hmm.
And that, as I recall, that especially for that time, that was a very unique deal. Netflix didn't have any kind of broader all-you-can-eat deal at the time, that was a pretty unique deal for Netflix. I can't remember them having a kind of a broad output deal that was non-exclusive. All those things were just seemed like anathema to them, but you got it done.
I got it done. And to their credit, they had the confidence from the data and just intuition. Netflix back then, there was a lot of intuition that was used other than just raw numbers. And I really credit, you know, Ted and Cindy early on for seeing the value in it and stepping up for it.
Mm-hmm. It was definitely a big commitment for them, mm-hmm. but showed. And it is so interesting that for all the bazillions spent on original content, when you look at the numbers every week, what drives FBI and Law and Order, and you know, it's the tried and true workhorses of broadcast TV, Grey's Anatomy.
Which is why part of my model right now is doing shows that are cost efficient. Listen, they're still going to buy big ticket products. You know, I saw, you know, some of the deals that were done, you know, announced that Apple bought something for a lot of money, and you know, and there's no stopping that. They're big drivers for new subscribers. They're highly marketable, and it's great television. So there has to be some balance there. And I think, for the most part, that's where I come in. Although I'm doing a series called Big Men about the story of Will Chamberlain and Bill Russell, and it came to me through Ideal Entertainment and a couple of other two really really talented writers. And they're like, you know, the most knowledgeable about the relationship between these two athletes. And that's going to be like a winning time. You know, it's going to be a big time scripted series. And we're going to have a really big name attached to it that's going to be announced shortly. And
as a star or a showrunner?
As someone attached to it who is a big athlete, who is a brand name athlete in the NBA, you know, played in the NBA. And then shortly afterwards, we're going to have a really big name showrunner. And this will be something that hopefully I'll read about and others will read about, you know, what we got for it. And hopefully it's something that will be award worthy, because I think it will, because it's not just the story of these two phenomenal athletes, you know, Bill Russell's whose number was just retired, and
sure,
Will Chamberlain, this legendary Laker, but also is really about the backdrop of the civil rights movement. And and if you look at all, you know, some of these stories are just so meaningful to being told in a different way. Hulu just started 1619, and there's just some great stories. And this is a great way, if you saw the movie 42, it was a great way to tell the story about equality in baseball. This is going to tell it in basketball with two legends. And I couldn't be more excited about it. I'm beyond excited about the success of Judy Justice, because it really demonstrates that this business model works. The audience shows up. They're showing up on a different platform. The streaming service and Amazon Freevee values it. They see the value in it. They're... the renewal is the best validation of it all. And really just showing that this huge talent, the biggest talent in all of television, could dominate on another platform.
Let me ask you, do you see the same kind of viewing? Is it appointment viewing? Do people come once a day? Is it a check-in kind of thing? Because Judy Justice airs on Freevee, and it was definitely one of the cornerstones when Freevee launched.
I will tell you that people are watching it at all hours of the day. And if they watch one episode, they watch most. It's just as excellent, you know, I don't want to say, you know, Amazon's very proprietary about their data, but I mean, and the biggest validation is the renewals.
Sure.
But people are watching it all different times a day. And I think they enjoy being able to have it on demand.
Are you thinking down the road in a couple of years you will package those episodes and find another window for them? Is that the plan?
The plan is absolutely to do that. Conversations are beginning. The question is the right timing mm-hmm. of it to really maximize the opportunity. But the business model for traditional syndication's got to change, and it's that business is just beaten down. And it's really got to change. I've been a little bit poking around the marketplace, and it's in desperate need of innovation. And I think I could certainly do it on the content side. And I think it's just going to require some of the people in the leadership positions on the broadcast side to be open to innovation, be open to windows, because, you know, you just can't run, you know, you see these stations running news after news after news. That's not the answer. The news is being constantly repeated through the day, and it's not, the news isn't exactly an exclusive product. It's on every single station in the marketplace. And so they have to be able to find a way to bring audiences back to broadcast to help their news do ratings, to help their 7 to 8 to do ratings, to help their prime time. And so there are all these time periods available, shows being canceled left and right.
And you're seeing third and fourth runs of the same show in a schedule. It seems
kind of
sad.
Times I look at it and just feel like they're giving up. I mean, it's really, you know, someone said to me, oh, we just want, you know, daytime for free. And I understand that people have budgets and they have financing issues. But at the end of the day, I think the conversation begins with, how can I get the biggest audience in a time period? Right now, reruns of Judge Judy, which is syndicated by CBS, mm-hmm. is like the highest rated number in syndication. It's like 6 million viewers a day in reruns.
Does that challenge, I mean, that's got to be a challenge for what you're doing with Judy Justice, because in some sense, she competes with herself.
I view it actually as helpful. Mm-hmm. I think that the viewers love Judy. They welcome more of her. Our money is more than, you know, the prize money that we give away to the winning plaintiff is significantly higher than what is on that show. And there are episodes that I haven't seen before on broadcast. So it's fresh content, and the proof is in the pudding. We know that they love her. So I think it's just further validation that any product that Judy puts her name on, by the way, I think for anything that she endorses or produces or creates will have high value in broadcast syndication.
There is a fascinating and incredibly well-reported new book out called Unscripted, The Epic Battle for a Media Empire, that really recounts all of the drama among Sherry Redstone, Leslie Moonves, Philippe Doman, many other characters. Have you read the book? Do you have any thoughts? Actually, even more so than have you read the book, do you have any thoughts? I won't ask you to go into the individual gory details, and some of them are pretty unpleasant, but do you have any thoughts about, like, what all of that cost CBS, a great organization, what all of that cost Viacom, which was an organization that was already having some troubles, but any thoughts about sort of the opportunity cost of all of that personal craziness? And in fairness, bad behavior.
My thoughts are is that there was really a way to make it work better than how I see that company today. And, you know, it's not just about assets, it's about people. You know, it's like baseball. You got to put if you got a guy playing second base who's batting 260 with 12 home runs, and you replace with a guy batting 300 and with Derek Jeter, then you got to put the right players in the right position to having a winning team. And so what the initial intentions were from the start in terms of what the team was going to look like, I think it was, you know, putting aside what the correct valuation was, what the correct number was to the Viacom shareholder and the CBS shareholder, putting aside those numbers and what the fair numbers were for, for the merger, I think that there was really a great opportunity there to build a great media company and putting this company back together. You have to also remember, I was there when the company was one. I was there,
right.
I'm 27 years in between both companies.
Right.
So I think that opportunity was
2000
there.
2000 to 2006, about 5 years. It was really actually not that long, but then they busted up in January of 2006.
Right. And so, you know, the team, and we were, I was part of the diligence team. There was definitely a goal to find a way to make it work and make it work correctly. And there were strategies in my head. I was up all night thinking about ways to help save the cable networks and how to drive more revenue there and how do we build CBS All Access up with potentially some of the Nickelodeon content. I mean, there was definitely a plan and a strategy, and I think the key stakeholders who I worked with, we were up day and night thinking, like, this is going to happen eventually, and how are we going to, like, really build a one great company for Shari Redstone? And, you know, sadly, because of, you know, the events that happened, you know, the lawsuit first and then the fallout of Les, none of that came to be, which kind of, you know, and it was exhausting. It was an exhausting time because we were paralyzed, as I said earlier, during this period of time of transition.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to leave us a review at Apple Podcasts. We love to hear from listeners. Please go to Variety.com and sign up for our free weekly Strictly Business newsletter. And don't forget to tune in next week for another episode of Strictly Business.
My name is Ariel. I moved to the U.S. at 19. I spoke no English and I struggled finding job opportunities. Everything I have, I owe to the Adult Literacy Center and getting my high school diploma at age 22.
It was an honor helping you achieve your greatness. Now you're helping others achieve theirs. It inspires me.
When you graduate, they graduate. Find free and supportive adult education centers near you at finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.